systemic family constellations helps us see ourselves as part of a system. So it explains why she would always think it's always on me. So you can look at it a little more historically, looking at the same problem through internal family systems, the parts work, you would have a conversation with that part of you that believes it's all on me, it's all my responsibility.
Hello and welcome back to the Your Great Podcast with your host, Uni Kamond. Today I sit with Terry DeMeo, who is a master relationship coach. She was my mentor when I went through the Martha Beck Wayfinder coaching, and I just really connected with her on so many levels. She's such a beautiful, intelligent woman. The process of being my mentor, you know, she didn't hold back. And sometimes that's not easy to hear about the things you don't do well. And yet it challenged me to fill in that space and grow, because ultimately I believe that is what we are all here to do, is challenge ourselves and grow. And without the discomfort of hearing feedback of, oh, you can do better with this and that, we don't grow, right? And I appreciate that kind of feedback in my own life, in my personal life, in my work life, because the only way I get better is knowing where I have improvements to make. And sometimes I can spot them, but sometimes somebody else can spot them better. So anyway, we chat about so many wonderful things. I get pretty personal about my own divorce and the process of going through therapy, and it was a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you get something from it. And again, thank you for being here with me. I do now have a Patreon account that I will link if you are interested in supporting the podcast. I do have another 12-week group coming up in September if you're interested in spending 12 weeks with me and the Bean Protocol, which is one endocrine cycle. One, you know, we basically get new cells every 12 weeks in the endocrine cycle. And a lot of times the healing, especially in the hormonal department, will happen in those 3-month cycles. Not to say that you can't see changes and benefits earlier, but it's quite often that those are the cycles that I see the biggest jumps in the hormonal system happen. Anyway, thanks for being here. Enjoy the conversation. Hello, Terry. Welcome to the Your Great Podcast. I'm really excited to have you here. You were my mentor when I went through the Martha Beck Wayfinder coaching, and I was just drawn to you as a person, as a spirit. So I'm really excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So my big question was, how did you go from being a trial lawyer and a law professor to becoming a master coach? That seems like such a big shift.
Yeah, and it was. I had a kid who was very dyslexic. And about the time I switched states, and when you switch states as perhaps a coach, a doctor, anything else but a lawyer, the rules of physiology follow you. The rules of human behavior follow you. Not so with an attorney. State law controls typically, even in federal court. It changes jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So I was basically, after a number of years in success as a lawyer, starting over. And my kid was struggling mightily to read. And so I started to learn a lot about it. And I first made a career transition to doing the work that helped him. Then I got really interested in stress. And I enrolled in grad school at Naropa, which is a Buddhist university in Boulder, Colorado. I was probably too old to really want to go through 3 years of training, 3 years of supervision, being out of the workforce, so that I could be a master's level therapist. I did the math. I wasn't going to live long enough to pay back the tuition and the lost income. And I discovered coaching. So it was really this kind of roundabout path that led me there. But stress and its various forms got me there and still keeps me fascinated how stress and anxiety impacts us so profoundly and how we try to control everything
to feel safe.
To feel safe. Exactly.
Feel safe.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. So what was it about stress that fascinated you so much when you started getting into it?
Well, when I started getting into it, what fascinated me was my own stress, because I was stressed all the time. As a lawyer, as a single mother, lots of opportunities to overcare, to take responsibility for that which was not mine. For example, I would represent somebody in a domestic relations situation, and you would think I had entered the marriage. I took so much responsibility for getting a good result, even when the client didn't bring me something that could result in a good result, or what they wanted was unrealistic. And so all of the internal stewing and perfectionism that I struggled with created a lot of anxiety in me. So I was at first very interested in managing it for myself. And then my experience with my son, because learning issues are hugely stress-based. The brain will tend to shut down when it's under stress, the higher thinking centers.
Right.
Fight or flight, which is protective when we feel threat, shuts down what they call executive functioning, planning, strategies, because we're not supposed to be able to calculate how fast the bear is running through the forest when we're getting chased.
Right. It's just run.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, it was really my own stress that got me most interested at first. But then I started to notice I wasn't the only one.
Oh, yeah. Not even close.
Right.
It's like it's inherited, from passed down from generations to generations.
Which is a whole nother topic having to do with the fact that it is passed down and passed along. Yeah.
The, what do they call it? We were talking about it before we hit record, the generational traumas that are passed down. Yeah.
And I am just finishing up a course of study in systemic family constellations, where we look at our lineage to see what's behind us that might unconsciously be influencing us now. So, for example, my own father, who was a pilot in World War II, that's a lot of responsibility and a lot of destruction. And my experience with my dad, because he never talked about, but he was checked out a lot of the time, off in space somewhere. And I remember, Daddy, 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 you're not listening, you're not listening. The frustration of being a child in that situation and not being heard and not being paid attention to. And as children, we start to wonder, is it me? Is something wrong with me? Why doesn't he give me more attention? So when we look at ourselves as part of a greater system, we can begin to see what influences might be hidden that we've never contemplated. It wasn't about me. Perhaps it was him. Perhaps it came before him. He came from an immigrant family, which is another source of upheaval. And in this country, in the U.S., most of us come from some kind of immigrant background. Yeah.
Such an interesting thing that you're laying out, because the child wanting attention, the parent being unavailable, and because little kids are so little, they're not going, oh, he had a traumatic childhood, he's not listening right now because he's just somewhere else. It's not about me. the only thing we know how to do is go, oh, I'm not good enough. There's something not right with me, exactly. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's something wrong with me. I'm not a good girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's no other processing and there's no other potential reason. And it would be interesting to know if a child actually processes it that far, or they just don't feel important. Like there's a sense of like, I'm not here, or I'm not seen, or I'm not important. Like, I wonder what the kid actually feels, but the outcome is probably just, I'm not important.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I remember that feeling.
Yeah.
I remember that feeling with both my parents for very different reasons. I must be doing something that caused this, which has a certain intelligence to it as a little kid, because it gives you some agency.
Right.
If you think that I am in this hopeless mess with these dysfunctional adults, you can begin to think you have no chance.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think I've done something to cause this problem, let me try to fix it.
Right.
There's some agency there. Of course, it's futile,
right.
But at least we're trying something. We're moving, which is healthy in the long run.
Which comes in the perfectionism. I've always looked at perfectionism as a trauma response.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
It's like, if I'm perfect, if I do everything right, then I'm important and then you'll see me and then I'm loved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's so deep. It's so prevalent. It makes you realize how many people are running around with that as their trauma response of, if I'm perfect, if I get good grades, if I, you know, I'm seen, I'm loved.
Right.
Yeah, I
right.
exist. Yeah.
Right. Right.
It's so intense. And as parents, like I know as the parent, is like, you're doing the best you can. But if the best you can is not, if there's no self-inquiry, then the best we're doing is historical. It's what our parents did, right? If there's no stop, pause, how do I actually want to handle? I think so many things, so many trauma responses are trauma responses because they happen so quickly and there's only time for regret. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. I worked with a client recently who, a woman lawyer, and it was almost a mantra of hers, it's all on me. Everything is my responsibility. And we did a constellations process where you actually map the family and its history. And she came from a lineage of really strong, independent women. And the men, either through war, through accident, through trauma, through abandonment, but it was a lineage where the men disappeared for one reason or another.
Wow.
And the insight that she saw immediately with this mapped out, it was so quick. It was so instantaneous. And running a law firm, it's impacting, because when an employee would come to her with an issue, unconsciously, or even sometimes consciously, she would begin to worry, I've done something wrong. I've caused this problem. So once we could see it systemically, she had this incredible insight that is helping her with her leadership, helping her trust her employees, helping her delegate more.
That's beautiful. So how does systemic family constellations differ from internal family systems? Like, and how did you, we were talking before we recorded as well, like, how did you choose between the two? Because you were at kind of this moment where you were like, I'm going to start with one. And are you going to go back to the other? Or how did you choose between them? And what is the difference?
Internal family systems is a process where you look inside yourself. The system is in you. And you identify the influences, they call them parts, the part of you that's scared, the part of you that's anxious, the part of you that worries excessively. And so problems are approached by interacting with the various parts. Systemic family constellations helps us see ourselves as part of a system, so it explains why, for example, in the example I just gave you, why she would always think it's always on me. So you can look at it a little more historically, looking at the same problem through internal family systems. The parts work might be somewhat similar because you're dealing with an issue that's internal in the same way, but the lens you're looking through
different.
Is different.
Yeah.
So you would have a conversation with that part of you that believes it's all on me. It's all my responsibility.
A different lens, or a different, like, it's almost like the lens of the family constellations. It almost seems like you're really stepping far back. Like you're getting this broad kind of eagle eye view of your family, whereas internal family systems feels like a real kind of deep dive into the complexities of internal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think what ultimately helped me decide is I think the systemic constellations, it's more visual. Mm-hmm. We're working with a visual map, either with live people representing your family members, or we can use little figurines, little wooden dolls, or plastic footprints you can put down on the floor. So I liked the visual aspect of it. And I also liked the somatic aspect that gives the immediacy of that. I did some other training, some coach-specific training in internal family systems, and I liked that very much as well. It was a tough choice. It was a tough choice, but I thought the somatic aspect and the visual aspect and the possibility of working in groups were what attracted me more.
For your coaching practice, do you have a philosophy from which everything comes from? You have a lot of training behind you, right? So now you have the family, the systemic family constellations, Wayfinder Master Coach. Do you find that you use all of these different tools with clients, or do you have you created kind of like your own system, so to speak?
I think it probably is my own system because it incorporates everything that I've learned. I've been coaching 17, 18 years now. So I trained with Martha Beck in 2007, master coach training in 2008, but I've studied pretty continuously various systems, approaches, positive psychology, Myers-Briggs, power dynamics for women, you name it. And if it'll help my clients and it sounds interesting, I want to go study it.
That's really cool. Yeah. We had talked a few months ago when we were setting this up. And one of the things that we had talked about is powerful women, beautiful women seldom feel powerful or beautiful. Why do you think that is?
Couple reasons. First of all, if we're looking at it systemically, historically, women, at least in Western cultures, were trained through the love of their mothers and grandmothers to be modest, careful, low maintenance, sweet, not making waves, in order to keep us marriageable, which was the safest place for us to be. If we couldn't marry and marry well as our social status would allow, we were destined to be old maids and looked down on and not protected. So we have generations of women behind us who have carried that forth, and it infiltrates us. So that's one of the reasons why it's hard for us now, doctors, lawyers, professionals, podcasters, brilliant women, carry that generational limitation. And then the other thing we were talking about earlier, as children, we begin to think that the limitations of our caretakers are somehow our fault. If it's my fault that mommy's in bed all day long, We don't know that she was drinking too much last night and she's hungover today and is too sick to get up and take care of us. As a little child, we somehow think that that's our fault. Or if we're criticized a lot, we will internalize that voice of the critical parent and try to correct, improve our behavior so mommy will get up and take care of us, or so somebody will stop criticizing us. And women in particular, maybe because of our history, women in particular are experts at running themselves down in their heads. Virtually every woman I've worked with suffers from that.
Doesn't matter how powerful they are.
Oh, that's totally beside the point. That gets discounted. I mean, I work with partners in major law firms making high six-figure incomes that have very low self-worth. Because, you know, the external trappings might feel good and be nice, but they don't lift up that deep sense inside that something's wrong with us.
Not
that
okay.
We're faking, that we're an imposter.
Where begins the process of turning that around? And I think of it as self-love. I think of it as, because a lot of times it's the love we didn't get that drives that ambitious part. Not to say that you can't be ambitious and feel loved, but a lot of times, like you said, you can have these powerful women who are beautiful and they feel neither. They're walking around feeling like a shell. And these successes are, you know, you can't really feel them like they're yours when you feel that way about yourself. So how do you, as a coach, how do you take this powerful person who comes to you and they have this dirty secret of, I've built this empire on...
It is the way they feel. Yeah.
Yeah.
The first step is always awareness. You've got to see what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of women don't really hear, they haven't tuned into that voice inside their head. And when they do, they're shocked. I remember when I began to tune into the one inside me that was calling me a loser and, you know, just really nasty, nasty stuff, no matter what I did. And it's shocking if you haven't tuned into it. So we've got to start there. There's a whole bunch of different ways that I would approach it. It's always individual based on who I'm working with. Some tools and techniques work with some people. Other techniques work better with others. But we start with awareness and then connection with the body. When you talk to yourself that way, notice what it does to your body. And by using the body as an immediate feedback system, once they begin to feel the impact in a more immediate way, they can begin to catch it earlier and earlier. And, you know, an exploration of, well, where does this come from? This sense that you're not successful, that you're not good enough. So we want to uncover a little bit about where it might have come from. Is it yours? Usually not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Usually not. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you can track it back. So I can really I'm beginning to really understand the systemic family constellations, because if you have this high powered person who doesn't have a sense of self-love and worth, and you walk back the cat, if you will, to childhood and maybe even generations beyond, what are the women in your family? How did they show up? How did they show up for you or not show up for you? You know, if you're a high powered woman and you have a lot on your shoulders, how is that then the torch being passed to your child?
And when I look at my own family history, the fact that I went to law school, I'm like a miracle. My mother had a high school education. My grandmother had to drop out of school in the sixth grade.
Wow.
And here I'm a lawyer coming from that kind of history. It was a shock to me.
How did you break the mold?
Who knows? You know, I mean, one of the things, because my own mother was pretty mentally ill, she was extraordinarily depressed and an alcoholic. My response to that, from that child view we were just talking about, I'm going to be as good as I can possibly be.
Right.
And so good grades were a place I could excel and get some attention. And I got positive attention at school for doing well. And it just continued. So, yeah, I never really set out to be a lawyer. It just kind of happened. I took the exam kind of by a fluke. I had a boyfriend that wanted, he was afraid to take it. And so I took it so I could tell him what it was like, the LSAT. And I did really well on it. So I applied to law school and got in, and why not? I didn't have any other plan. A lot of people go to law school thinking it's a versatile degree and you can do a lot with it. So
yeah,
school was always the safe place for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So did your mom give you accolades for getting good grades? Like, was there some positive feedback on your education?
I wish. My mom was, she was not functional enough to
okay.
realize what I was doing.
Okay, so then that translated to outward attention and love.
Yeah, I got attention in school. My dad liked it, but it was just part of this, I have to be really good, that started so early.
Yeah. Yeah. So inside of you, did you not actually feel good, even though you were performing at such a high level?
Oh, yeah. I felt awful. I felt like I was a fake, like I was just one day away from everything crashing down, from my being exposed as the fraud that I was. And it, you know, a lot of therapy, workshops, coaching, self-awareness. It's a process.
And once you met her, was that a shock to you to be like, wow, this was the driving force? Or how was it for you to actually meet that little girl? Was it a little girl for you? Was it like, in what form did it come to you?
Really in many, many forms. But where I first became aware of it was when I tuned into that voice inside me. When I began to hear the way I was talking to myself and regarding myself. And it was pretty relentless. You know, I was waking up too early or too late. You know, one of the really defining moments for me was maybe about 10, 12 years ago. I was standing in line in CVS one afternoon, and I heard that voice. What are you doing here? You should be home working. Look at you messing up, goofing off in the middle of the afternoon. And I looked down into my hand and I had a tube of toothpaste. I had gone out to buy toothpaste. And I was standing in that store attacking myself. And I was like, wow, if I'm giving myself a hard time over that, I need to really take a look at that. And I was already a master coach by then and still going at myself like that. I had come a long way to be sure, but I hadn't really taken a deep dive into what it would take to lighten the way I was treating myself. So I made that a personal project.
Sounds like a worthy one. Yes. I think it's shocking, honestly. I remember, and for me, it was the healing process when I was really sick. That was when I really became aware of that internal critic, that internal never good enough, and started noticing that voice. And really this just lack of respect for myself and love for myself and kindness towards myself. And I treated everybody better than me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You would never treat a friend that way,
No.
or your child that way, or your partner that way.
No. And to see that gap between how I treated others and how I treated myself, I would work all hours for my boss. I would do anything, for my family. And then when I got sick, I realized I had unloved myself into illness. I had unloved myself into illness. I had, you know, I thought I was doing all the right stuff. I'm prioritizing family. I was a single mom at a certain point, and I'm working for them, and realizing, thinking I'm being selfless, only to realize how selfish it was because I led myself to illness. I led myself to being in bed for years, and then I realized, like, oh, actually not taking the time to learn how to love myself and not taking care of myself, that was selfish. Like, the thing I was doing, I thought was not selfish, but in the end, it was like, oh no, actually, not taking care of myself was incredibly selfish, because I became such a burden to my partner, my family, my kids. Like, they don't even remember that they spent most of their time with me reading books to them in bed. I couldn't even. Didn't have the energy to tuck them in or do simple things. And it was so humbling to realize that I had this narrative that was all wrong. Like, it was just all twisted and turned. And it was the moment where I think of it, for me, my journey was the cultivation of self-love, like cultivating the self-love and care and kindness and time and effort and hearing the voice. It was really, my journey to all of this coaching stuff was actually with Byron Katie. That was kind of my jumping off book. It was a radical idea of, is it true? Why are you fighting with reality? Like, how did I remember going through Wayfinder and going through the part with Byron Katie, and it feels like that work feels potentially controversial. Like, what is your thought around that work? But that was big for me. Her work was big for me.
It was big for me as well. Is it true you're a loser? Is it true nobody loves you? Is it, those kind of things can be really, really powerful. There is controversy around it. It can bypass a lot of issues. It does not take into account social conditions. Is it true there's racism? Yeah, you bet it's true. It's got to be used carefully, strategically. So in the right way, it is a very, very powerful tool. What concerns me also, as somebody who taught coaches for so many years, is that part of that process can be used as a, what's the word? Bludgeon against ourselves. So part of that process, is designed to help us see our projections. So and so is a terrible person. And then we look for the projection by finding where we believe we're terrible. I always would warn my clients, this is not to be used as a tool in your personal war against yourself. We're simply looking for how what you're seeing out there might be alive inside you too. So yes, it is very powerful. It helped me tremendously, and it needs to be used with care.
It was for me, I was going through a divorce when I found her work, and it helped me distinguish, have a kind of like a gauge for distinguishing reality, because it can get fuzzy. It can get fuzzy with emotions. And so that, is it true? Because I would think these thoughts about myself that my ex would say, and to be able to ask myself if it's true and to run through this process, it would set me free, because I would walk around with all of this kind of ugliness, and just to be able to have this gauge of what was actually true, it was one of the keys. It was one of the pieces. And I think of her work as that. It's one of the pieces of the puzzle, potentially.
Agreed.
Are you still teaching master coaches?
I left the Martha Beck training last summer. I had taught, maybe you didn't know that. I had taught for 17 years. And I got so interested in family constellations, and I really wanted to immerse myself in it. Just a bit of a challenge for myself, too, letting go of that little bit of a lifeline.
Yeah, you're growing and changing. I love that so much. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
How long is the training for the systemic family?
The one I'm doing is an 18-month training. I have a feeling I will be training in it for quite a while longer. You know, I can do really pretty good one-on-one sessions now. I feel really confident there. The bigger challenge for me is going to be working in groups.
Wow. So you can do it in groups. You can do that kind of work in groups.
Fascinating.
Wow.
So if, for instance, we were in a group of 20 people and I was working with you on a question you're having, why is it so hard to let go of this marriage? I'm in a divorce. Why is this so hard to let go of? Because I'm the one who asked for it. Let's say that's a theoretical question. So I might ask you a few questions about your family history, your mother's line, your father's line. Maybe we wouldn't even need to go up the line. Just maybe your mother and father, we'd get enough right there. Or maybe we'd do it more immediately with your husband. But I would say, choose somebody from the group to represent you and choose somebody to represent your mother. And these are people who don't know anything more about you necessarily than that basic minimum information we just got. And they enter what we call the field, the center of the room, and they start to have feelings and interactions that can provide incredible insight. I thought when I was going to learn it, that it was some kind of magical process I was going to learn. And my teacher assures me there is nothing magic. It's really the universal experience coming through. So we might bring in other people. Let's bring in your grandmother and see what happens and watch them interact. And you and I are sitting on the side watching these three people interact. And then as a facilitator, my job would be to ask, what's happening to them? What are you noticing? And then to you, what do you notice as you hear that? And it unfolds from there. Usually takes about an hour. And it is just a fascinating process.
That sounds really fascinating on a lot of levels. The question that came to me when I was listening to you is, what if you are adopted?
Yeah.
And you don't know who your birth parents are. You only have your current parents. So if there's generational stuff, how do you begin to even tap into that?
Well, you bring in the birth mother, you bring in the birth father as either representatives or symbolically, like I said, you can use footsteps, you can use the little dolls.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I lay it out on a piece of poster board with post-it notes.
Mm-hmm.
But just seeing things systemically and relationally, information begins to emerge. I have a client right now who was either given up for adoption or taken by family members and given up for adoption at birth. She's not quite sure, but we do this work and it's very, very illuminating.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you base it off of her innate responses to things of where those things might have come from? Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why she experiences life the way she experiences it.
Mm-hmm.
And we might bring in the adoptive mother as well,
mm-hmm.
to add another layer or perspective to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it definitely shows up. It definitely can be done. And it having that is really important. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds really beautiful work. And there's a lot of conversations right now around generational trauma. So having a tool to work with sounds really powerful.
Yeah.
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 So are you currently taking clients? And what Who would you say are your average clients, or do you work with families, individuals? What does your practice look like?
My practice is eclectic, but mostly I'm working with women in kind of high stakes situations. Should I leave my marriage? Or I'm in a divorce and I need some support. Or I've been betrayed within my marriage and I don't know what to do. Should I leave? Or I work with, obviously, a number of women lawyers. I work with some physicians as well, with professional degrees where there's lots of pressure on them. The jobs themselves carry a lot of stress. And then how is that leaking into their personal relationships with their partners, with their children? So yeah, that's basically my practice, where the stakes are really high, and you want a partner. You want somebody to talk things over with who doesn't have a stake in the outcome.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you to leave your husband or stay with him or leave your law practice and go become a artist. Not my job, but I love getting in really deep where important questions are being considered.
Yes. And in those cases, you would definitely want to master somebody who's holding under has all of these tools available to help guide that, you know, that conversation, because it's big. Those are, so you like the pressure cookers. I see you.
I do.
I see that.
It was my life for so long.
Yeah.
I know it so well. I've been divorced. I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to grapple with those questions. I know I was a single mom and a practicing trial lawyer. And I did the juicy stuff. I did criminal, civil rights, domestic relations. So, and I've got that experience as well. And I don't know, for one reason or another, that's always what I go for, is the deep end of the pool.
Well, it's a deep understanding.
Yeah, I feel very, very comfortable there.
Yeah. Which is what's needed: comfortable, calm, creating this safe space where you can explore these really deep. I am curious of how many people that come to you, you know, should I stay or should I go? How often is it about the other person?
It's never just about another person. There's always two in every relationship. I mean, sometimes it's pretty clear that, you know, if there's abuse going on, it's pretty clear that the person needs to go. But my job is to help them figure out if they're ready to take that step. It's a tough step, even in the abuse situation.
Yeah.
I don't get that too often, thank goodness.
Yeah.
You know, it's usually not that cut and dried.
Right. And what I love about your coaching is that you're eliciting the wisdom of your client and the truth of your client to get to the choice versus, you know, and that's a growing process, right? It's a growing process to get to the point where you're willing to make a choice. So that, and that takes time and patience and exploration and honesty. And I know, because I've been there, and I remember my therapist, I would go to therapy every day for years and she would just sit there and listen. And then one day I came in and I was like, I think I need to get a divorce. And she was like, I was wondering when you were going to get there. And I think, you know, the difference between a therapist, it's almost too passive. And what I love about coaching is that they're powerful questions to begin eliciting truth, right? Where I felt like I was at this big circle on the outside of the circle. And over the years, I just kept getting, the circle kept getting smaller until finally I went, ah, I actually need to leave. Huh. And she's like, yes. And I was like, wait, you knew this? Yes, but you needed to get there. And so, you know, there's something about that approach that I look back and I'm like, geez, I could have got there a lot quicker had I had somebody partnered with me where I could, you know, because I was going to therapy because I knew something wasn't right. I knew I wasn't happy, but why? Why wasn't I happy? And obviously that's a multi-layered conversation of like childhood and unhappiness and lack of self-love. Like there, it's a whole right. mess of a whole melting pot. But the unhappiness then was I was with a partner who did not support me. And that was just making me smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm. And so 5 years, 10 years of therapy, aha, I mean, this is not a good.
Well, you know, in fairness to therapy, hopefully during that 5 to 10 years, you emerged from the marriage with a lot more strength.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. That, yeah.
You know, yeah. So, you know, we don't want to leave situations too precipitously either without.
Yeah.
Really knowing what we're going to be up against out there without the foundation, the internal foundation that we need to survive as a single person.
With two kids, I was 27 with a 2 and a 5-year-old. Wow. So yeah,
that's a huge decision.
Yeah. It was after the birth of my first child. I was like, I mean, I was in therapy before just to work on my own business, but and then afterwards, I was like, wait, this isn't, but it, and yes, I acknowledge that too. Like the time that it took to get to that moment, those years were spent building a foundation of myself in that process. But I still remember the moment that I had that moment of like, oh, I need to leave. And her going, yes. And I was like, oh. Well, shit, you saw it because you're like an eagle back here watching me take these turns and turns and turns until finally I got to the center of it. And that is what drew me to coaching, was to have the tools to ask powerful questions to elicit important conversations, because that's where the change happens. That's where recognition of ourself and our truth happens. And I couldn't think of a better person to do it with than you, to be honest. Like I've really admired your work. So it was, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And especially since you're calm under fire.
At least with my clients' things. No, I'm pretty calm with my own stuff too these days.
Good.
I use my tools.
Yeah. The tools almost, I don't know about you, but the tools for me almost become automatic where I don't even notice I'm using them anymore, where it's just like, you know, things just kind of come to me where I'm like, oh, is that true? No. Wow. Interesting. You know, let's dive into that a little bit.
Yeah.
Where's that thought coming from?
Yeah. And I work with myself very somatically. Am I grounded? What do I really want here? What am I feeling? Where am I being drawn?
So much of it is just slowing down.
Yeah. To tune in.
Exactly. Tune in.
Exactly.
So many of my habits I broke just by pausing, just by going, wait, sit with this, be here with this. Like that, so much for me, so much of trauma was speed, things happening so fast.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. If I just hurry up and make a decision and change this, that anxiety is going to go away now.
And then it's replaced with a new anxiety of, is that right?
Or we marry somebody who looks exactly different. I mean, they look radically different and they're exactly the same. The same issues emerge. Yeah. I've not seen that happen.
Yeah, looks different. Well, also, I think that there are, you know, kind of the perceptions of what we think we want. And, you know, I know I married my dad the first time around. And it was, but I didn't think I had. I thought I had rebelled and gone the opposite way, only to realize that the opposite way was exactly 100% the way.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. You I'm think you're rebelling.
Differently.
Yeah. Nope. We only do it differently when we're different, right? It's like, that's when we do it differently. It's when we're actually different and we're not attracted or attracting the trauma bond or the wound or the, you know, the validation. For me, in my case, that was like, I married one person, did the work, got out of that relationship, and then just married a good person. Like, oh, that's what that looks like. It's nice. Yeah.
Look at that.
Well done. 10 years of therapy, well spent.
Yeah. So see, it
yeah.
was.
Yeah. Yeah. All those turns, right, to the center of the issue was, well, the center of the issue was layers of issues, but to uncover it to be strong enough to make that decision, you know, that was the peeling of the layers. So if somebody's listening and they're just starting inquiry, any words of wisdom for them?
Be very, very kind to yourself. I think that's the wisest approach. And what you just said, having the patience to really feel what you're feeling before you take action.
Yeah.
So kindness, awareness, tuning in will really go a long way. One of my mentors says, never move faster than you can feel. Isn't that good? And so what's meant by that is to make sure you know how you're feeling about something before you make the decision.
Yeah.
How does this marriage really, really feel?
Yeah.
How does this situation really feel? Yeah.
That's good. That's a really good insight right there.
Yeah.
Because like I said, so much of trauma is fast moving to try to alleviate that anxiety.
Just right.
Keep moving forward. Keep going. Just make that decision, you know? And so, I mean, I guess there is the opposite of like analysis paralysis where you're analyzing, but what you said is so beautiful because if you actually get out of the brain and into the body and start to feel, then you can actually break that cycle as well. Of like, what do you actually feel? Not what do you think? Because if you say, what do you feel? A lot of people go, I think.
Exactly.
And it's like, no. Not what do you think? What do you feel? What's in the soma? What's in the body? Terry, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your journey, your wisdom. Where can people find you?
Well, they could find me online. My name, terrydemeo.com. I'm sure you're going to have something in writing.
I will list everything.
My name is a little unusual to spell, but yeah. Or an email to terry@terrydemeo.com will find me.
Beautiful. I will link all of your information, and you are just a wonderful, lovely human and a joy. And I appreciate you so much. And again, for your mentorship, it meant a lot to me. Your feedback, your interactions, your honesty, your kindness, and holding me accountable to be a good coach. I really appreciate that as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And it was a pleasure chatting with you today.
Yeah, really wonderful. I hope it is helpful for anybody listening. And I hope they reach out if they're looking for some guidance.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for spending your time with me and Terry today. Well, I hope you're doing well wherever you are in this big, beautiful world, morning, evening, afternoon, taking care of that incredible body, nourishing it with so much love. We have such a big opportunity to transform the way we relate to stress via the foods we eat. And I can't stress it enough, that the food we eat will either ground us and center us or be part of the dysregulation of living this big full life that most of us have. So explore how nutrition plays a role in your stress or not. See you soon.